This is Free Food for Thought, a student-run, student-focused podcast here to feed your curiosity. I'm Emma.
And I'm Ryan. And today we're sitting down with Justin Brooks. Justin is the director and co-founder of the California Innocence Project. Under his direction, the project has exonerated dozens of innocent people, trained hundreds of law students, and changed multiple laws in California related to wrongful convictions. Justin has also worked extensively in Latin America. He's the founder and director of California Western's Latin American Institute for Law and Justice, as well as the founder and director of Red Inocente, an organization devoted to starting and supporting innocence organizations throughout Latin America. He's also the author of the only legal casebook devoted to the topic of wrongful convictions, and the new book, You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent, which details what he has learned about wrongful convictions from his more than three decades as a criminal defense attorney and innocence organization director. Justin, thank you for joining us. It's a pleasure to speak with you today.
Absolutely a pleasure for me. Thank you.
So Justin, let's start with your upbringing. Where did you grow up and how did your upbringing influence your path up to this point?
Sure. So I was born in the Bronx, New York. In the 60s, my mother was a British school teacher. My dad was an Australian tennis player. And I lived all over the East Coast growing up. I spent my high school years in Puerto Rico. And, you know, I mentioned that because that was probably the most significant part of my childhood in terms of impacting the direction of my life. Living in Puerto Rico was the first time I saw real poverty. I learned to speak Spanish. I started seeing my country in a little bit of a different way because Puerto Rico is part of the United States, but not always treated as if it's part of the United States. And so I think my social justice trigger was triggered by living in Puerto Rico in my high school years. I went on to college, went on to law school, became a criminal defense attorney. And I became a law professor. And one day I read in a newspaper about a young woman on death row in Chicago, and she was sentenced to death on a plea bargain. And that didn't make any sense to me, so I went and met her. It ended up, I found out she was factually innocent. And that's what led to me creating the California Innocence Project and devoting most of my career to freeing innocent people from prison.
So going, I guess, right after that, of your initial founding of the California Innocence Project, I'm sure, given this was a sort of new endeavor in California at the time, there's a sort of learning curve or a lot of initial hurdles I'm sure you faced. Could you talk a bit about that in your early years with the project?
Sure. That's a great question that no one really ever asks me, but I like that question. Yeah, I came to California with this notion of I was going to free innocent people in California, and I was going to do it out of law school using students as my investigators. But at first I thought, well, how am I going to get cases? And then the LA Times did an editorial saying, welcome Justin Brooks to California, and here's what he's going to do. And the mail just started coming in. And since then, I've received, you know, boxes of mail, you know, every day, thousands of letters from people in prison all saying the same thing. I'm innocent. I need help. And so developing a system to process those letters, to get into the cases took me a few years. And it was not easy. So I eventually developed a questionnaire with all the information I wanted from people in prison to assess their case. I set up a system of getting a hold of transcripts and appellate briefs. And I created this team of law students and lawyers that started reviewing them. And that's what we've been doing for the past now 24 years, is cases get reviewed. We get the material together twice a week. There's presentations in my office where lawyers and law students present cases to me. I have the awful Caesar-like power of thumbs up or thumbs down about which cases proceed. And if I think it's a case where we possibly have an innocent person in prison and we might be able to prove it, we keep going with it, keep investigating until we find what we need.
Regarding that, what are some criteria like you use to determine if a case should go be reviewed?
Yeah, so I just finished writing this book called You Might Go to Prison Even Though You're Innocent, which is now available on Amazon for pre-order. And that's kind of what the book is about. It's all the causes of wrongful conviction and kind of the red flags to look for. So the leading cause of wrongful conviction that I've seen in the last 24 years is bad identifications. Because when somebody goes into court and says, I'm 100% sure that's the person who committed the crime, that's enough to get you convicted. But we now know that there's all kinds of problems with memory. There's all kinds of problems with police procedures in doing identifications. So I look very closely at cases where someone's convicted on an identification. We've also learned that a lot of people falsely confess to crimes they didn't commit. And 17% of the DNA cases where people were exonerated with DNA, those people confessed, even though they were innocent. So I look to cases just based on confessions. Then there's a whole range of faulty sciences that we've learned about. Bad science applied to arson cases, bad science applied to bullets. The worst for me is bite mark evidence. It's absolutely junk science, and a number of people have been released after being convicted on that. So it's sort of like, you know, it's like when a plane crashes. When a plane crashes, you study the plane crash, you try to figure out what went wrong, and you try to avoid future plane crashes. In my world, we study every one of these cases. We look at what went wrong in those cases, and then we try to apply that knowledge to other cases that look very similar.
So I guess kind of looking at the more macro level of the last 24 years with the California Innocence Project and those lessons you've learned, how has your work with the project changed generally, and you know what, I suppose, core tenets have stayed the same?
Yeah, great question. The core tenets that stayed the same, I'll answer that first, is that there's always been innocent people in prison. It's just, and it's global. Every country in the world has innocent people in prison. There's no such thing as a perfect criminal justice system. They all have flaws. They're microcosms of our society where people are making decisions and people make mistakes. So that hasn't changed. What's changed is, I think, the general public's attitude towards our work. When I first started, I was getting in arguments with people about whether there were any innocent people in prison. And I think we're far beyond that now. We've documented more than 3,000 cases of wrongful conviction in the United States. We see it on the news all the time. We hear about it on podcasts and on Netflix with Making a Murderer and all this stuff that's been out in the popular culture. So I think that's the biggest change, is that the general public has grown to accept that there's innocent people in prison. And that's helped us in our work. That's made better juries. That's made judges more cautious when they're looking at evidence. I think we could do better, but it certainly has changed.
In your opinion, what is the most important reform to criminal justice system that could be made today? And how do current social justice movements like restorative justice and Black Lives Matter fit in the discussion?
Big question. So to start with, what are reforms that could be done? Well, right away, there are very simple reforms that could really improve our system. For instance, in California, we've just recently passed a law mandating that police officers who know who suspects are cannot participate in identification procedures. And the reason is because they're not good poker players, and they often indicate who the suspect is. Or the witness might say, number three kind of looks like the guy, and then the officer will say, oh, good job. And now the witness is sure it's number three, and by the time they go to court, they say, I'm 100% sure it's number three, not kind of looks like. So that's a very simple thing. Another very simple thing, recording all confessions. I still hear the argument that police departments will say they don't have the resources, yet everyone on the planet is walking around with a recording device in their pocket. If they just took their cell phones out and hit record, we would then know what happened during those 12, 13, 14 hours of interrogation. So the jury can really weigh that evidence and understand whether it should be given a lot of weight or hardly any weight at all. So there's a lot of those police procedures that can be reformed and really improve what we're doing. In terms of the Black Lives Matter movement, it is the most extraordinary criminal justice movement in my lifetime. Typically in the past, when you had criminal justice reform issues, you'd be lucky if you could get 50 people out at a protest. I've been at many, many tiny protests. I've been at protests with three people. The Black Lives Matter movement, we saw millions of young people, and not just people of color, millions of white kids out on the street protesting for a better criminal justice system. And we're already seeing positive impacts of that. Colorado became the first state to start taking away police officer immunity from lawsuits. And if the entire country followed that and the police could be sued, it would change the system. But right now we have so many layers of immunity that it's very, you can never sue a prosecutor, you can never sue a judge, and you can only sue for police actions if they're extraordinarily outrageous, like way outside their job, like shooting someone who's unarmed. But it, you know, we see those as the big cases where people are getting shot, but there's many, many, many millions of smaller violations that need to be actionable to really change the culture of policing in America. So I'm optimistic that your generation is going to make things better. I don't know if my generation has done a good enough job, but your generation seems much more fired up about it.
So here at Claremont McKenna College, we have a lot of students studying and actively working on a lot of urgent issues like homelessness, climate change, criminal justice reform. And I think something we all struggle with is trying to put those issues down at the end of the day. So I want to ask you, how do you sort of achieve a work-life balance when the cases you're working on are so dire and pressing in nature?
I mean, I don't think I have. So if I'm giving an honest answer, I don't have a good work-life balance. I mean, when I walked in here to talk with you guys just a few moments ago, you know, I took 3 phone calls between, you know, walking a half mile over here because I don't ever stop working because my clients are always in prison. It's you know, every day that I take off from this work, I think is another day for everyone on every case I'm working on. I'm lucky that I have an amazing team. My team of lawyers are all my former students, and you know, we're a very close-knit group. We give each other a lot of support to get through the work. I'm lucky I have a good family life, 2 great kids. My one son just became a public defender. He's San Diego's newest public defender. I'm lucky I live at the beach in San Diego, and that can't be treated as too small a thing, because when I drive over the hill and I see the ocean and I'm home, it helps. But this life is not a life for someone who wants a steady 9-to-5 Monday through Friday, sort of flatter life. What I say to everyone is, like, if you want a life with incredible highs and incredible lows, this is the life. Because when I walk an innocent person out of prison, and I've walked 38 of them out of prison, there's no better thing you could do. I mean, I'm bringing people home to their families. I'm giving them their lives back. And so those days are the best days of my life. But when I lose a case and I know they're innocent and I just can't get through to the judge or whoever's in front of me the truth, it's hard. And one of my cases, I spent 27 years trying to get her out of prison. And I started the case when I was 29 years old. I finished the case in October, and I'm 57. That's how long sometimes these cases take. So it is not for the faint of heart.
What advice would you give to students who hope to follow in your footsteps and work within or reform the criminal justice system?
I mean, if it's something you're passionate about, go for it. My advice to all students about anything they want to do in their lives is find something you're passionate about, because otherwise it will be a long, boring life. And if you find yourself in a job where you're looking at the clock the same way you were in high school with whatever job you had then, quit. Because that's not what it should feel like after you've spent a lot of time on your education and a lot of money on your education. It shouldn't feel like working at McDonald's in high school. You got to find something you're passionate about, and then the days go by quickly. And, you know, sometimes I'm on planes with people and they'll say, oh, this flight is so long. And I'll say, God, I wish I had another hour on this flight because I got to get this work done. So I have a complete different concept of time than most people because I'm very wrapped up in my work. It's more of a mission. It's more of an identity for me than a job. And I think if you can find that, it's a much better life.
Now, shifting gears a bit, I wanted to touch on your work with innocence organizations in Latin America and ask you, how do you think the current democratic backsliding we're seeing across many of the countries in the region, El Salvador, Bolivia, Guatemala, just to name a few, how does that impact your work and how do you feel about the future for law and justice in Latin America?
Things are always shifting in Latin America. 20-some years ago, I trained the first 12 public defenders in Chile after the fall of Pinochet. And Chile went from this incredibly repressive regime where people were being pulled out of their beds at night and put in concentration camps, executed. And now Chile has one of the best justice systems in Latin America. And I think I learned a lot by seeing what happened there, in that the pendulum swung so dramatically one way that it swung back the other way. So people in Chile just didn't trust their government at all. And there's a certain percentage of the population in the United States that doesn't trust the government, but most of us by and large do trust the government. So we don't get these sort of, we haven't had the crazy swings kind of in anything in reality. I mean, when we talk about inflation, we never have hyperinflation, countries that have like 100% increase in prices in a month, things like that. We don't get into extreme crime situations. We haven't had a war on, you know, our actual within our country in, you know, a couple hundred years. So you don't see extremes in the United States. But when you work in Latin America, you really do. You see regime changes. You see the whole country just shift in other directions. So right now, my focus is mostly on Mexico. Mexico has trials for the first time in 400 years. About 7 years ago, they decided to start having trials. And the reason that was important is because in Mexico, until recently, you could never cross-examine a police officer, and a police report was deemed valid, whatever they wrote in it. And you have the second most corrupt police force in the world, second only to Egypt. And no one ever questions their work. So I spend a huge amount of my time now training lawyers in Mexico how to do cross-examinations, how to put on trials within the new system. And I've got a lot of faith that things are going to get, I mean, I got to have faith that things are going to get better. It's a much bigger challenge than Chile because it's so much bigger. I'm working with a lot of people to get a curriculum in the law schools in Mexico to train law students how to do trials. And guess how many law schools there are in Mexico? There's 200 in the United States. Guess how many in Mexico?
No, 80.
What do you think?
40.
There is 2,300 law schools in Mexico. It is an undergraduate curriculum. It's not graduate school. There's no bar exam, and there's no certification for those schools. So they are churning out hundreds of thousands of lawyers that aren't getting proper training because they're not learning these skills they need to operate in the new criminal justice system. So Latin America is just, I love it more than anything. I love working there. The challenges are outrageous. And I've been fortunate that I've been able to help start 30 innocence projects in Latin America. We've got projects in Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Argentina, Mexico, Costa Rica, all throughout the region. And they're kind of little micro centers for changing the system, where they're working on cases and then promoting them to the public to see the problems within their system. We just won a big case in Mexico that went to the Mexican Supreme Court that was actually featured in a Netflix series called Duro Razonable, which is subtitled in English. But it's that way change is going to happen. You know, we have to teach people about even their own justice system. They did a poll in Mexico, and most Mexicans thought that they had jury trials in Mexico from watching dubbed American television. And not only did they not have jury trials, they didn't even have trials. Everything was just filed on paper, and judges just made decisions without questioning any witnesses. So, you know, the shifts, you know, Brazil obviously has been a nightmare in terms of their government. But I try not to get down about it, and I always know there's going to be shifts back and forth, countries getting better, countries getting worse. And when you have a global vision of the world, that's what you see. You know, it's like you turn on the news every day, you hear all the bad stuff going on, and it does start to get you down, like the whole world's a total mess. But that's not true. There's places where things are getting better. It's just more news, the places that are getting worse.
We have just enough time for one more question. Could you tell us about a book, song, or movie that has been on your mind recently?
Oh, I mean, the song that's always in my head is Bob Dylan's I Shall Be Released. I think that's sort of, that song so resonates with me. And another Bob Dylan song too, The Story of the Hurricane, because I actually knew Reuben Hurricane Carter, who the song is about, who was one of the first people that came to fame as being an innocent person in prison in the 1960s. The problem with this work is you can literally never get away from it in popular culture. I mean, the public seems to have an insatiable appetite for crime stories. I try to do the opposite when I'm at home. I watch HGTV. I don't watch anything about crime. I've never seen Law and Order. I've never seen CSI. I don't read books about crime. I'd rather read a Victorian novel about, you know, people living in villages in the 1800s in England than, you know, watch Breaking Bad. So, yeah, I look for escape from this world when it comes to popular culture.
Well, that's unfortunately all the time we have for today. Thank you, Justin, for joining us.
And to our listeners, remember to stay hungry.